This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with professor and attorney Gerald Horn on his new book, I Dare Say, A Gerald Horn Reader. Gerald Horn, according to Cornell West, is one of the great historians of our time. His book has excerpts of some of the 40 books he's written about racism, internationalism, and resistance, a terrific introduction to the work of this great scholar. We also speak with longtime criminal defense attorney Michael Deutsch of the People's Law Office. Michael Deutsch has been part of some of the most important political legal defenses in American history over the last 50 years. But what he's most concerned about is what's going to happen now against the people who've been supporting Palestine.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Angela Davis once stated that radical simply means grasping things at the root. This makes understanding possible. What are the roots of our present dilemma? Where did capitalism come from? And what accounts for its great success? Where did racism come from? When was it implanted? Why is the alternative to the capitalist Democratic and Republican parties so feeble? What did Malcolm X really stand for, and what did he try to accomplish before he was assassinated at age 39, the same age that his contemporary Martin Luther King was assassinated 5 years later? How does this contribute to the weakness of our movement? This weakness can be traced back most immediately to the anti-communist witch hunt of the 1940s and 1950s, and to the destruction of the left wing of our once powerful trade union movement beginning in 1947. The danger that Malcolm X presented to the powers that be can best be understood by his internationalism, his reaching out to leaders in Africa, his desire to go to the United Nations to mobilize against American racism. Today's political activists are drawn to the works of historians to appreciate where we're at, how we got here, and what to do next. Our guest on Law and Disorder, Gerald Horn, has written about these profound events. His reader, I Dare Say, has just been published by Orr Books. Cornell West called Gerald Horn one of the great historians of our time. Horn approaches the study of history as a politically engaged scholar with an insightful and necessary partisan stance. He graduated from both the University of California Law School and Columbia University, where he got his PhD in history. Gerald Horn has been active as a leader of the National Conference of Black Lawyers and is the author of 40 books as far-reaching as The Origins of Capitalism, Racism, Settler Colonialism, Boxing, and Jazz. He's currently a chair professor of African American history at the University of Houston. Gerald Horn, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for inviting me.
Gerald, it's good to be able to talk to you. I remember when we both were on the executive committee of the New York City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. That was even before Heidi became the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild. And then you became the head of the National Conference of Black Lawyers, an organization which we very much admired. In any case, let me start off with our discussion with you. You're a scholar, but not a politically disengaged one. What was it that made you political? What formed your political consciousness?
Well, I would say growing up black in Jim Crow St. Louis, Missouri, I would say living in the United States and becoming aware of imperialism, particularly as it manifested in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, and of course, a healthy diet of reading.
Let's talk about your new book, I Dare Say, subtitled A Gerald Horn Reader. You write about racism, internationalism, and resistance. Could we please start by asking you to summarize your understanding of the roots of slavery, white supremacy, and settler colonialism in the U.S., and also how England went from being a minor monarchy on the fringes of Europe to a large power and sponsored colonies in the U.S. going back to the 16th century in North Carolina?
Well, fortunately, your question dovetails with my book, The Dawning of the Apocalypse. More to the point, what happens is that as Europe is expanding post-1492, you have the secession from the Catholic Church, speaking of Martin Luther and Protestantism in 1517, and then it takes London by storm by the 1530s under Henry VIII. I'm sure many of your audience know the story about him and his multiple marriages and possibilities for divorce being blocked by the Vatican. And that secession leads to a round robin of religious conflicts between Protestants and Catholics. That forms the backdrop for London's expansion into the Americas, because as the scrappy underdog, London had difficulty in standing up to the Catholic power, Spain, most importantly, which had first mover's advantage, since after all, it sponsored the freebooter Christopher Columbus. And so as I tell the story, sort of improvisationally, you saw the construction of a new monetized and militarized identity known as whiteness. That is to say, you had a kind of forced reconciliation between those who had been warring in the British Isles, English versus Irish, English versus Scots, and then that expands to incorporate those who had been warring in Europe, British versus German, German versus Pole, Pole versus Russian, Russian versus Ukrainian, Serb versus Croat, Northern Italian versus Southern Italian. And that turns out, at least insofar as the creation of the United States is concerned, it turns out to be the winning ticket, particularly given the fact that as we speak in 2024, the U.S., at least for the time being, reigns as the world's reigning superpower.
Gerald, you see the 1776 American Revolution as a settler revolt led by slaveholders. You say that characterizing the 1776 American Revolution as one for liberty, equality, and democracy is a creation myth. Why do you say that?
Well, certainly 1776 was a great leap forward for those of European descent. It was a great leap forward for settlers, more pointedly. But how could one say that it was a great leap forward for the indigenous population? How could one say it was a great leap forward for those of African descent? After all, in the late 18th century, there were thousands of enslaved Africans in what is now the United States. By 1861, there were millions. Not only that, but by the 1830s, if not before, the United States had seized control over transporting enslaved Africans to Cuba. During that same decade and shortly thereafter, they became the primary force in terms of transporting enslaved Africans to the biggest market of all, speaking of Brazil. And in any case, I think it's important to put 1776 in a wider context. That is to say, Canada was a province of London, but it did not revolt. And yet, if you look at Canada today, it has a single-payer healthcare system that the United States can only pine for. If you look at other settler revolts, such as Algeria, culminating independence in 1962, it would be difficult to say that the French settler project in Algeria was a great leap forward. Ditto for Kenya, culminating independence in 1963, that was a British colony. Or, for example, the revolt of the Afrikaners in the late 19th century in South Africa, which was squashed by the British colonialists. So we have to be more measured in our analyses of settler revolts. I mean, for example, by way of comparison, if you had a settler revolt on the West Bank, for example, against Israel, I'm not sure if there were those who would claim that that settler revolt was somehow a great leap forward for humanity. And that's the context in which we should view the United States, and particularly as a lawyer, we should take judicial notice of the fruits of 1776, which includes rampaging across the continent into the Pacific by the 1890s, overthrowing the Hawaii Kingdom, genocidal wars in Indochina, for example, sponsoring religious zealotry in Afghanistan. The list is long.
If this settlers' revolt served to maintain slavery, as it seems to have done, why is this not widely recognized?
Well, that's a good question. However, the good news is that there is a growing scholarship that does acknowledge this, not only my work, but you may be familiar with Tyler Stovall, a black American who rose to the top ranks of the historical profession, including president of the American Historical Association, the leading body of historians in the world. His book, White Freedom, and not only cites mine, but tracks mine. If you look at the book by the late philosopher, also of African ancestry, although Jamaican in his case, speaking of Charles Mills, The Racial Contract, he revisits the whole so-called bourgeois democratic project in very pointed terms. And of course, if you look at the recent documentary by the Haitian former Minister of Culture, Raoul Peck, speaking of exterminate all the brutes, it's a sweeping castigation of the very concept of settler colonialism with a scorching analysis of slavery and indigenous dispossession.
Professor Gerald Horn, you write that capitalism attained liftoff as a direct result of the plunder of the indigenous peoples and the mass enslavement of the Africans. Isn't it true that this understanding is both profound but not widely understood or accepted?
Well, that's probably an accurate perception, although, as with my previous response, you've had a number of writers over the years who have made that point, of course, Karl Marx in the first instance, but also Walter Rodney in his book, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, which is based upon extensive research. The University of Rochester historian, Joseph Nkori of Nigerian ancestry, wrote a book, England and the Industrial Revolution, which makes the point about how London's wealth and preeminence with the British Empire was basically based upon plunder of Africa and Africans in the first instance. So once again, the work is out there. Whether or not it becomes the consensus view is more or less a political question based upon political conditions. And given the strength of the right wing in the United States of America as we speak, it's problematic and difficult for what is perceived to be a radical analysis of capitalism to gain traction. But once again, as this century proceeds, I think that that so-called radical analysis will become the consensus viewpoint.
You mentioned your earlier book, The Dawning of the Apocalypse, and excerpts of that are included in the recent I Dare Say, a Gerald Horn reader. Can you talk a bit more about the foundations of white supremacy in the American settler colony?
Well, as noted, if you look at the 1580s and what London called North Carolina, and as suggested by my previous remark, London was trying to steal a march on his Catholic Majesty in Spain, who, after all, in the 1580s, was occupying Florida due south. This was difficult, however, because the Catholics, which used religion as a major marker of distinction and, in fact, nationality, to be blunt, grossly outnumbered the Protestants. And so improvisationally, as suggested, you had London seeking to incorporate those they had been warring with, including the Irish, including the Scots, and then, as I suggested, leapfrogging into incorporating even those they had expelled at the end of the 13th century. I'm speaking of the Jewish population, which was expelled from England in 1291. But by the 1580s, a desperate London, and to be fair, also a Protestant Holland, a Protestant Dutch as well, a move to incorporate the Jewish diaspora against the interests of Spain, which, as you know, had launched the Inquisition, that is to say, convert to Catholicism or die or be tortured. And certainly what London had on offer was more pleasing and promising to the Jewish diaspora than the prospect of an Inquisition. And so this Jewish diaspora, therefore, was incorporated into this larger construction of whiteness. And despite some bumpiness along the way, including the attacks on synagogues and all the rest, it's fair to say that if you compare the experience of the Jewish diaspora in North America with the Jewish population in a good deal of Europe, there's no doubt that the the United States excelled in that regard. The problem is that some of our friends on the left have looked at that comparison and have suggested that that means that the United States was a progressive project, not acknowledging or realizing that this incorporation of the Jewish diaspora in part was a response to the settlers' need for warm bodies, for labor power, for militants, for soldiers, to repress the indigenous population and to corral the Africans. I'm working on a book that'll be out in a few months that deals with Southern California. And one of the footnotes deals with the first Jewish person acknowledged under the U.S. flag in San Diego. It turns out this man was a noted Indian fighter, and I think that says it all.
Yeah, really. Gerald Horn, Malcolm X warned about both the Democrats and the Republicans, saying that both parties have sold us out. When Glenn Ford was on Law and Disorder, he spoke about the black misleadership class, a description phrase that he coined. An example he used was Senator Cory Booker from New Jersey, who takes big corporate money and supports the right-wing program of charter schools. Both Malcolm and Glenn Ford believed that the most effective path for black liberation was independent political action. Do your studies bear this out? I'm thinking of the path of W.E.B. Du Bois and Shirley Du Bois and Paul Robeson.
Well, assuredly, you may recall that W.E.B. Du Bois himself ran for the U.S. Senate from the state of New York in 1950 on a third-party ticket, doing quite well, by the way, during the midst of hysteria about the war in Korea, the Red Scare, and the Cold War. And fast-forwarding to 2024, you don't have to stop with Cory Booker. You could look around in your own New York City and espy Gregory Meeks of Southeast Queens, the ranking Democrat on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, not to mention Mayor Eric Adams, the Speaker-in-Waiting Hakeem Jeffries, who have been remarkably quiet with regard to castigating Israeli depredations in Gaza that are proceeding with rapid velocity as we speak. However, even before we get to that question of independent political action, we also must recommend and suggest and advocate that not only the black community, but the labor movement as well, which too had to endure the wrath of the Red Scare, should be more internationally minded, because international forces have played a historically positive and profound role in pushing the United States away from enslavement of Africans and pushing the United States away from the ravages of Jim Crow U.S. apartheid. And so if I were to make a policy recommendation, I would suggest that both labor and the black community should be sending delegations far and wide to the African Union headquarters in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, to Brussels to confer with the leaders of the European Union, given the contradictions and conflicts between the EU and the U.S. that are proceeding apace, and of course, to CARICOM, their headquarters being in Georgetown, Guyana, not to mention Beijing, Tokyo, and Moscow.
Professor, the American ruling class today is in crisis. It's suffering a decline in hegemony around the world. We're in debt. In the USA, half of our people are poor, near poor, and many go hungry. The conditions of daily life for many are meager. Please talk about the objective situation here as we enter the election season.
Well, I think your comment says it all. I mean, there's a crisis of everyday living in this country. There's a crisis with regard to inflation. Part of the problem of this multifaceted, multi-pronged dilemma has to do with the weakness of the aforementioned labor movement, which is, once again, a reason why if we were to make a policy recommendation, we would stress and recommend pushing forward legislation in Congress in Washington to make it easier to organize unions, such as the PRO Act, for example, which fortunately came up at least briefly in Mr. Biden's State of the Union address when he gave a shout out to Sean Fain, the leader of the United Auto Workers Union. But this is a complex question that can only ultimately be resolved with the downtrodden, with the subalterns organizing independently and politically, as noted in our previous discussion.
This is Michael Smith. I'm here with my co-host, attorney Heidi Boghossian. We're talking with Professor Gerald Horn on Law and Disorder. Gerald, the great playwright and political thinker Bertolt Brecht wrote that to understand fascism, we must look behind it to capitalism, from whence it comes. Your thoughts on this, please.
Well, assuredly, not only Bertolt Brecht wrote movingly and provocatively about fascism, but also the late Anglo-Indian writer and Marxist, speaking of R. Palm Dutt, D-U-T-T, not to mention Georgi Dimitrov, the Bulgarian communist who stared down the fascists in Germany itself in the 1930s in the wake of the so-called Reichstag fire, where a fire was set in order to provide a rationale for squashing the left-wing forces then on the rise. Interestingly enough, fascism also was mentioned in the title of her last book, speaking of Madeleine Albright, former U.S. Secretary of State, in her book, Fascism, A Warning. I would suggest that in a country like the United States, which is based on settler colonialism, and settler colonialism being a project based upon class collaboration between and amongst the European settlers and their descendants, fascism is always a possibility. And I think that that's one of the reasons why you have had such an understandable concern about, for example, the fact that in Nashville, Tennessee, you have the rise of a neo-Nazi group called the Blood Tribe, a very blood-curdling descriptor, if I must say. And I'm speaking to you from Houston, where just a few weeks ago, you had an open demonstration by neo-Nazis sponsoring swastikas, waving a flag with swastikas under the banner, quote, "Down with Jewish supremacy," unquote. Obviously, this is something that the Zionist lobby should attend itself to, rather than trying to squash J Street and Jewish Voice for Peace, and if not now, but that may be asking too much.
Let's talk now about what we can loosely refer to as the U.S. left. I think that would include the Democratic Socialists of America, left-wing people in the Democratic Party, non-party socialists, and even several socialist and black nationalist organizations. Why do you think the U.S. left cannot flex its muscles?
Well, part of its ideology, as noted, I'm not sure if there is a firm grasp on the history and contemporary reality that grows out of the history of the United States of America. I find it remarkable that of late, understandably, there have been the idea that the Zionist project in historic Palestine represents settler colonialism. I salute that assertion. But yet, somehow, the idea of settler colonialism in North America has not taken hold. And as noted, if you do not see the United States as a settler colonial project, you probably will not be able to recognize class collaboration, which is a major impediment with regard to the rise of the U.S. left. Speaking of which, and linking our previous discussion with this one, I'm still taken by the fact that in 1991, a scant 30-odd years ago, you had David Duke, a Nazi and a Klansman, running for governor of Louisiana, receiving about 50-plus percent of the Euro-American vote across class lines. If you look at January 6, 2021, that was a remarkable display of class collaboration. You had CEOs flying in on private jets. You had declassed elements. You had military veterans. You had cops. You had workers. You had shopkeepers, most of whom, of course, were of European descent, if not all. And so the inability to recognize what is staring at us from the mirror, I think, is one of the major debilities, I'm afraid to say, of the U.S. left writ large.
Professor, speaking of Trump, it appears that he's leading Biden in the polls, but that he may avoid, at least up until the election, going on trial in four different venues where 91 counts of illegality have been alleged. It seems likely he'll be elected, and he may get the charges dismissed or pardon himself. With this in mind, what do you think the left, as we've described it, should be doing? And what are we facing?
Well, that brings us to the nuts and bolts of U.S. political life. I mean, intellectually, there is an understanding of the Electoral College and the role it plays in the election of the U.S. president. That is to say, the election of U.S. president, the person who gets the most votes does not necessarily prevail, as Al Gore or Hillary Rodham Clinton. It's basically 50-plus different elections. And so I'm speaking to you, as noted, from the state of Texas. Democrats have not held a statewide office in the Lone Star State in decades. And so to suggest that all the forces on the left should simply robotically and lockstep vote for Democrats, when we should be looking at this presidential race as an opportunity to, as noted, build a third force, to build an alternative political party, obviously makes eminent good sense. There are only about 10 states that are in play with regard to the November 2024 presidential election. And it does not include, for example, the Golden State, where Mr. Trump does rather poorly. But that suggests that a third-party insurgency should be high on the list of priorities of the U.S. left. And I could go down the list. Hawaii is another state, a so-called blue state, where you could speak in that same vein. Because certainly we should be concerned with this rise of Trumpism. We should be concerned by the rhetoric concerning calling immigrants, quote, animals, unquote, speaking of a, quote, bloodbath, unquote, if he does not prevail, although admittedly he was speaking of policies with regard to the auto industry. But given the fact that he's encouraged violence amongst his supporters, we should take that rhetoric very seriously. And certainly if you put it in a global context, you have to take it even more seriously. You might have seen the strength of the ultra-right in the recent Portuguese elections, Chega. And Portugal has a proud left-wing history after the overthrow of fascism in 1974. This is obviously a paramount concern. The rise of the Alternative for Germany, the AfD, in the seedbed of fascism, speaking of Berlin. The fact that in Italy, which could contest Germany in terms of being the seedbed of fascism, you already have in power Prime Minister Meloni, who comes out of a neo-fascist background. And then you have the South African elections coming up in May, where the neo-apartheid party, the Democratic Alliance, is being encouraged by Washington as we speak. And because of the fact that as a result of the retreat of Jim Crow, the black community had to throw overboard its most internationalist forces led by Paul Robeson and W.E.B. Du Bois, there has not been significant intervention by the black leadership on the question of foreign policy, which means that the South African election is basically sailing under the radar, despite the surge of this rightist neo-apartheid party. And so this is all putting wind in the sails of Mr. Trump's vessel, and that is why we need a more pointed strategy that takes advantage of the contradictions of the Electoral College in order to begin that long march towards political independence.
Professor, we've run out of time. How can our listeners follow your very important work?
Well, I'm not underground yet, so I'm easy to find. And I'm particularly easy to find with regard to lectures too numerous to mention on YouTube. But I think that that's one of the best ways to follow my work. And of course, there are books. I should mention in this context that my next book will be out in a few months, entitled Armed Struggle, with a question mark following, Panthers and Communists, Black Nationalists and Liberals in Southern California through the 60s and 70s. Look for it at better bookstores and various sites everywhere.
But I just want to add that before you look for the future book, there's one that just came out this week called I Dare Say, a Gerald Horn reader. Cornell Welch calls the book one of the great historians of our time. And I would definitely recommend getting this book. I've been reading it over the weekend. It's terrific. I dare say, a Gerald Horn reader. And Gerald Horn, thank you so much on behalf of Heidi Boghossian and myself for being our guest on Law and Disorder.
Thank you for inviting me.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Historically, when the people of our nation rise up in massive opposition to policies and actions undertaken by their government, those that are deemed, that is, essential to its foreign or domestic policies, then various governmental agencies invariably begin to process of trying to shut down or seriously weaken the people's movements against those policies and actions. That's what happened in the 1960s and early 70s during the movement against the U.S. war in Vietnam. In the 60s, when the movement for civil rights was so active in our nation, it happened as well. Or more recently, in response to the movement on behalf of immigrants' rights. And so it's not at all surprising that the pro-Palestinian movement in the United States, which in the wake of how Israel is conducting its war in Gaza, has exponentially increased in size and in public view, would immediately become the focus of renewed governmental as well as private repression here in America. Colleges and universities are shut down. Groups like Students for Justice in Palestine, Jewish Voice for Peace, college presidents were called to testify before Congress. Some of them lost their jobs, whether they claimed they had done enough or not with respect to anti-Semitism. The U.S. House of Representatives initiated and continues an investigation of the pro-Palestinian movement. Private employers have withdrawn job offers to students and others who join the anti-Israeli protests. And authors and speakers deemed too supportive of the Palestinian cause continue to be disinvited or banned from speaking at various public forums. Often, governmental efforts to intimidate or undermine these peace and social justice movements include actions that are not visible to the general public, secret actions. Actions such as sending undercover agents into the targeted protest groups in order to disrupt the group. Electronic spying on the groups and group leaders escalate. And as the case with the movement now protesting Israel's actions in its war in Gaza, a war backed by the United States both politically and militarily, various U.S. policing agencies are now actually consulting with and visiting with and working in concert with governmental agencies in Israel. Well, today, joining us to discuss how the United States policing authorities are responding to the mass movement on behalf of the Palestinian people, we're going to be fortunate because we have joining us as our guest a human rights attorney whose career is comprised of countless challenges to such governmental practices and the defense of many activists targeted for prosecution as a consequence of their political activism. His name is Michael Deutsch. He is a lawyer with the famed Human and Civil Rights People's Law Office in Chicago, Illinois. Michael has also served as the legal director for the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City. In the course of his career, he has been a criminal defense lawyer for the rebelling prisoners at Attica, and later was a coordinator in the Attica civil lawsuit where, after 2 decades of litigation, there was finally a settlement of $12 million in damages. Mr. Deutsch has also represented the Black Panther Party members, the Puerto Rican nationalist prisoners in the 1950s, who won an unconditional sentence, commutation, from President Carter in 1979. And more recently, Michael has represented Razmia Odeh, the deputy director of the Arab American Action Network, a former Palestinian prisoner and torture survivor.
Attorney Michael Deutsch, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Michael, before we get into our main topic, which is the discussion about the repression against people who've been active in support of Palestinians. I wanted to ask you, if I might, what are the roots of your political activism?
Well, when I graduated law school, I was kind of involved in different things in law school. But then when I graduated law school, I accepted a clerkship for Otto Kerner, who was then on the United States Court of Appeals. And he had a kind of a progressive background, and I basically did that for a year, and that's when I ran into some people who were from the People's Law Office. And I wanted to do what they were doing, fighting a good fight against repression. And so I joined the People's Law Office in 1970, and my political activity just ballooned after that, and I was involved in a lot of political cases, you know, representing a lot of political people. So that's really the whole story of how I became active.
Michael, Jim Lafferty said it in his introduction that historically, whenever there's been a militant mass movement of people in our nation in protest against important domestic or foreign policy actions of our government, the government often responds with various repressive measures designed to weaken or destroy those movements. And Jim cited the reaction of the U.S. government to the movement against the war in Vietnam and then the movement against racism as examples. Do you agree with me? And if so, please talk to us about this.
Absolutely, I agree with you. Repression of political movements in the U.S. and abroad is a feature of U.S. policy and a function of U.S. capitalism and imperialism. Since I began working with the People's Law Office and then later on I was a direct legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, I have been involved in representing activists fighting repression from the Black Liberation Movement, about COINTELPRO, about the murder of Fred Hampton, the Indigenous Peoples Movement, the Chicano-Mexicano Movement, the Puerto Rican Independence Movement, the Palestine Justice Movement, Prison Resistance Movement, and Occupy Anti-NATO Movement. And all those movements, in my experience and work, have been victims of political repression because they opposed U.S. policies.
So with respect to today's mass movement against the government's military and political support for Israel in its war against the people in Gaza, have those efforts to stop or undercut the movement's effectiveness included U.S. government policing agencies working hand in hand with counterparts in Israel?
Absolutely. The Israeli security and intelligence forces are working closely with U.S. prosecutions and the FBI and trying to create cases against Palestinians who are fighting the occupation and educating people in the U.S. about the situation in Palestine. In all these cases that have been prosecuted in the U.S. against Palestinians, you have the heavy hand of the Israeli government involved, providing classified documents to the U.S., disinformation, false testimony, efforts to criminalize Palestinians. And so there have been a series of cases in which the Israelis and the U.S. have worked together to repress Palestinian activists.
Attorney Michael Deutsch, the movement against the U.S.'s role in the Israeli-Palestine war is, in a sense, not a new movement. Oh, the war in Gaza with its unimaginable humanitarian toll has certainly caused the pro-Palestinian movement to grow, much larger and more visible than before. But there's been a long-standing people's movement in America against the Israeli occupation and its treatment of the Palestinian people. So is it the case that the kinds of U.S. actions Jim identified in his introduction as being employed to disrupt and discredit the movement have been going on in various forms for decades, too? I'm referring to spying, placing FBI and other agents into the movement to undermine it, and targeting leaders of the pro-Palestinian, pro-Arab movement for prosecution and that sort of stuff.
It's been going on since the late 80s, early 90s. There's some famous cases, one of Sami Al-Aryan, who was a professor in Florida, who was targeted by the Israelis and then indicted by the U.S., There's the Holy Land Fund, who was providing necessary and needed material support for people who were living under occupation, and they've been charged and tried, and all their leaders have been given long sentences. And Samuel Arian spent about 5 years in prison, and then when he was ready to get out, they subpoenaed him to a grand jury, which he refused to testify in front of, and he had to do another 4 years in prison.
Michael, let's talk about the Oda case, which I remember, I think you were on Law and Disorder speaking about it years ago. She was a woman from Palestine living in Detroit for 20 years, and the Israeli government, I think, prompted the American government to go after her by saying that she lied on her application for citizenship. Can you tell our audience what happened to that poor woman?
First of all, she was the deputy director of the Arab Action Network, Arab American Action Network, which is a group in Chicago that does a lot of organizing in the Palestinian community. And she had been living in the U.S. for 20 years. 10 years earlier, she had gotten her U.S. citizenship, so she was allegedly protected. And then all of a sudden, based on information supplied by the Israeli government, the U.S. government in Detroit said she lied on her citizenship application, saying she was never arrested for any crime. And they then provided all this material that the Israeli government provided to them, and said, oh no, she lied, and therefore she should be charged with a criminal charge and then ultimately deported. And this was a big case because she had a lot of support in Chicago and Detroit, and it was clearly an overreach by the U.S. government and by the Israeli government. We had a long trial. She was arrested when she was a young activist and tortured, and finally she was allowed to leave Israel after spending 5 years in prison. And then she just became an activist in the U.S. So we had this long trial. They refused to let us put in the information about her having been tortured by the Israelis, having confessed to acts that were under torture, and how the Israelis treated her. The federal court would not let us put in that information. And ultimately, she was convicted. And then we had another motion to retry the case because they didn't let us put in her state of mind about what under torture and why she would have lied about that. So then we were going to have a second trial, but they still weren't going to let us put in the stuff about the Israelis. And ultimately, we made a deal where she would not do any time in prison, but she would agree to be deported, and she was deported first to Jordan, and now she lives in Ramallah and doing quite well. But there was a lot of support for her, and it was clearly another case of the Israelis' heavy hand directing this type of prosecution.
You're listening to Law and Disorder Radio. This is Attorney Michael Smith. Our guest today is longtime criminal defense attorney Michael Deutsch. Michael, another tactic the U.S. government uses on behalf of undercutting the effectiveness of movement groups protesting U.S. foreign policy actions like the war in Vietnam or the pro-Arab, pro-Palestinian movements is to criminally and often arbitrarily charge its leaders and members with having committed criminal acts, correct? And hasn't that already been happening to the pro-Palestinian anti-Israeli war crimes movement? Please talk about that.
Yes, the U.S. government, with the support of the Israeli government, and particularly under Attorney General Ashcroft, who was the Attorney General under George Bush, George W. Bush, tried to indict and criminalize Palestinians who were working against the occupation and were living in the U.S. One of the things that they used were grand juries to force people to come before them and give information, which most people did not, and therefore they were in prison for contempt, first for civil contempt and later on for criminal contempt. And the case of Sami El-Arian, who was accused of being a member of the Palestine Islamic Jihad, which was a ridiculous charge because he's a professor in Florida and had no connection with them. So he was also indicted and charged and did time in prison. And I mentioned the Holy Land case, where the leaders of the Holy Land case, based on testimony of Israelis who testify secretly without any giving their names or their backgrounds, were given high sentences after being convicted for providing material support, claimed that they were providing material support for Hamas, whereas they were providing desperate need for people living under occupation. So there is this whole history. They've used the RICO indictment, RICO conspiracy against Palestinians. They've charged them with material support for terrorism and with refusing to testify in front of the grand jury.
So what in fact constitutes the giving of material support, and what in fact constitutes an act of terrorism?
Yeah, that's a good question. First of all, the material support statute, 18 U.S.C. 2339 A and B, is about the Secretary of State gives the power to the Secretary of State of the U.S. to designate Palestinian groups and other groups as foreign terrorist organizations, FTO. And as a result, all the resistance groups in Palestine are on that list. They've been designated a foreign terrorist organization. And if you give material support to one of these groups that are designated, then and that group either directly provides material support to commit a terrorist act, or Section B, which says, if you provide any material support to a designated terrorist group, if you're working under their direction or in conjunction with, then you can be charged with terrorism. And even though you had nothing to do with any terrorist act at all, you can still be charged with providing material support for terrorism. And that was one of the ways that people have been charged by the U.S. government, because of this designation that they provided some type of support to a designated foreign designated organization. And this could be anything. This could be writing an op-ed article about Hamas or about Palestine Liberation Front, or doing any type of work that somehow interacts with helping these organizations that are foreign terrorist organizations. So that's where material support comes in. It comes in under the Anti-Terrorism Act of 1996. Now, people think that there's a domestic terrorism law, and to some extent, there's no standalone law, federal law, that charges anyone with domestic terrorism. But there is a law which says that if you commit acts of dangerous to human life in order to intimidate or coerce the general public or affect government policy, and you violate what is called in the statute federal terrorism crimes, which are assassination, kidnapping, destruction of aircraft, chemical weapons, attacks on federal facilities. Those are the limited crimes, federal terrorism crimes, that you can be charged with if you intend to do them to affect government policy or intimidate or coerce the general public. So when you have these people saying, oh, they interfered with traffic or they blocked a doorway, that is not domestic terrorism and is not cannot be charged under the U.S. law. If you, you know, commit an act of violence dangerous to human life and do one of these crimes, then you could be charged with terrorism.
Michael, you've handled a number of cases in this respect. Is there any recent case that you could briefly tell us about that raises some of the issues that we've been talking about?
Yes, the case against Mohammed Salah and Abdel Halim Ashgar is a classic case of what the Israelis do and how they work with the U.S. government. Mohammed Salah was a citizen of the U.S. living in Chicago, a small town, a small grocery store owner, and a member of his mosque in Bridgeport, Illinois. He was asked to bring money over to the occupied territories to help a group of Islamic leaders who were deported to Lebanon and kept isolated in the forest of Lebanon without any funds or resources. So when he went there with that in mind, he was arrested, tortured for 47 days, and ultimately was brought into a group of Palestinians in prison who he thought were comrades, but actually they were birds. Birds are people that make you sing. They were complicit in working with the Israelis, and they continued the torture and got him to give some kind of statement, and ultimately he was then brought back to the interrogators, and they made him sign a statement. He was then, with nothing to do but plead guilty, he pled guilty to 5 years in prison. They claimed he was a leader of the Hamas, a military commander of Hamas. That's what the Israelis put out. And in fact, he had nothing to do with Hamas other than helping in this one situation. He did have 5 years in prison, and then he came back to the U.S., and as soon as he arrived, U.S. Attorney Ashcroft and the U.S. Attorney in Chicago had a big press conference and said he was a military commander of Hamas and charged him with a RICO conspiracy, along with Abdelhalim Ashgar, who was a Palestinian doctor, who marketing doctor, a PhD, and he been in prison in New York for refusing to testify in front of a grand jury. After doing months in prison, the judge said, well, you can't be coerced, so I'm going to release you. And sure enough, they indicted him in Chicago for not only being part of this RICO conspiracy, but also for refusing to testify again in front of a grand jury, which he did. And so we had this trial where they brought in the interrogators who testified under code names, who brought in all this classified information, and any information that the Israelis give to the U.S., which is classified, it's automatically classified by the U.S. So they wouldn't tell us how the methodology or anything. They cleared the courtroom when we had the suppression hearing. But the Israeli interrogators were sitting at the counsel table with the U.S. attorney, and everybody else, the press and all the public, was kept out of the courtroom. And, of course, the judge ultimately found that the confession could be put into evidence. So then we had this long trial, went on for months, and we were able to, through the course of that trial, educate the jury about the Israeli occupation of Palestine. We had experts come in about torture, experts about how human rights are violated by the Palestinians. And as a result of that, after a three-month trial, they were both acquitted of being involved in any type of conspiracy, a RICO enterprise, which was Hamas was called the enterprise. And the jury acquitted him of that. But Ashgar's refusal to testify in the grand jury, they now had charged him with criminal contempt. And he was sentenced to 11 years in prison for refusing to testify in the grand jury. And Salah, who was acquitted of the RICO charge, was convicted of filing a false statement in an interrogatory in a civil case. And he was sentenced to, I think, 4 years. Ultimately, you know, they did their time. They're still, Mohammed Salah passed away a couple of years ago, but Dr. Ashgar is still fighting. They're trying to deport him to Israel, and he's claiming that he'd be tortured if he went back there. So he's in front of the immigration court. He just had a hearing about a month ago, and now, which was denied because he claimed that he would be tortured, and under the Convention Against Torture, he shouldn't be sent back to a place where he's going to be tortured. So now that's on appeal. But the whole Salah case, which we wrote about in great detail in the Journal of Palestine Studies, which people who are interested should be able to get that online, It was a result of a crazy case in which human rights were thrown out the window, except for the jury was able to understand what was going on and claim. We got them after the trial. They didn't believe the Israelis, and they thought this was just an overcharge for no good reason.
Michael, tell our audience again how they can get the information on the Saleh case.
It's in the Journal of Palestine Studies. There's two parts to it. It's a quarterly journal of Palestine Studies. It's called Secrets and Lies, The Persecution of Mohammed Salah. So if you just go to the Journal of Palestine Studies, although it was also attached to that interview I did with people from Hard Crackers, but if you go to the Journal of Palestine Studies, you'll be able to get both Part 1 and Part 2.
Michael, it's been terrific talking with you. Could you, before we have to say goodbye, give us our last thoughts? I'm very concerned that the people that are out there now in support of the Palestinians are going to suffer a lot of repression when it finally comes down. Give us our last thoughts on what you think is going to happen.
Well, I can't predict the future, but I would think your concern is justified. I think that at some point, the government, with the Israeli backing, is going to go after some of the leaders of the protests that are going on. Tremendous protests, unbelievable protests. And people are not giving up. They're continuing to do that, despite the fact that the Biden administration continues to fund the Israeli genocide. So I think this material support thing is dangerous, because every resistance group from the Palestinian movement is now considered a specially designated terrorist foreign terrorist organization. So if they think there's any type of connection between anyone in these groups or providing any type of what they call material support, which can be anything, as I said, doesn't have to be related to terrorism at all. It could be writing an article or making a forum about one of these groups. So this is my concern, that they're going to try and criminalize the movement and call it terrorist. And there's already some inklings. The terrorist task force of the FBI has been around visiting people. This is where they're going to go if they go anywhere. And this is a concern for me as well.
Michael Deutsch, thank you very much for being our guest on Law & Disorder. Every best wish to you. And we're certainly really privileged to be able to speak with you on our program. Thanks again. You take it easy.
Okay. Thank you, Michael.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.